Ah, here we go.
All right, guys. My name is Jeremy Christensen from Vidor, Texas. From Lake Charles. And I brought a couple friends over here, Monterey and Michael. They're from the same city as me. I'm going to tell my story briefly, but to start the movement model out, 2 Timothy 2:2. Anybody got it?
In the things you've heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable men who will also be called by the teachers.
Yes,
close?
Yeah, pretty close.
Okay.
I don't think you missed any of it. Entrust these things to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Depends on what translation you're going with. But, man, I'm glad to be here. I've only been coming to these. I came to one of these about, 10 years ago. I think we were at the Woodville place or something similar. You were there. I don't remember. I think I met you there. And TJ and Russell were there, too. And I remember taking a picture with everybody. And then there was this big, long layoff of me being in youth ministry. Where I was trying to chase and do this youth ministry model of this thing that I had seen. But my story really starts with the movement model, really starts whenever I was a sophomore in high school. Here's what happened. I'm powerlifting. I was one of the top guys in the state in powerlifting. And I squatted something like, I was 130-something pounds, squatting about 450 pounds. It was a pretty good deal. But TJ Horner comes up to me. He was my judge on the platform. He comes up to me afterwards. I recently became a Christian in ninth grade. He comes up to me afterwards and said, "Hey, you're pretty strong, but I can make you stronger." And I was a Christian. I was wearing a Jesus shirt. And so he's kind of zeroing down on me. He's getting his recruiting going. And him and his father-in-law, Paul, they were training athletes at their house, at Paul's house. And anyway, he invited me to come over and start training with him. And all along, I didn't know, but he had these motives of finding someone who's faithful. Like 2 Timothy 2:2 says, and he starts building a friendship with me, starts building a relationship with me, start getting to know one another, and then he asks the question, "Do you want to start meeting together and going through the Bible?" And he used the word discipleship, and I had gotten to know TJ. I think it was Rick who, our last retreat, what was it called? The process that he was talking about. What was the title of his thing?
Yeah, Rick. Is it the armor of God?
No. Anyway, he was talking about relational ministry, basically. Living Proof. There you go. So it was basically he was spending time with me, getting to know me, kind of earning the right to speak into my life to where I would listen to him. And because of that relationship that we had built through powerlifting, through a mutual interest, I said yes, mostly because I could look at his life and see that he was not like my dad. My dad didn't know the Lord. I could tell that he was different. I could tell that he had something that I didn't experience at home. And I knew at the time that it was the Holy Spirit, that this guy was filled with the Holy Spirit, that he was living a life pursuing righteousness. And I didn't know at the time, but I needed that. I needed a mentor. I needed someone to hold me accountable in life. So I said yes, started meeting with him, going through. Didn't look like this at the time, but going through book one. And it only took us about 15 years to get through 4 books. But we eventually got through. We were really bad at going through the books, but man, he taught me a lot about life. lot about eventually being a husband, a lot about raising kids. I got to see how he did that, and I took notes. I took notes. A lot of things that I watched in his life, I've been able to, you know, apply to our lives at home. So, man, what you guys have done here, starting with you guys, starting with Jay, and man, it's trickled down and it's impacting. It's impacting my little ones at home. Your faithfulness is impacting my youngins, and they're talking about God. And my little guy, he wants to be baptized, you know, and we're talking about that, and we're talking about following Jesus, and it's all because of this. It's because someone reached out to me and said, "Hey, I want to disciple you. I want to pour into your life. I want to show you what a Christian truly is." And yeah, it just brings me back to 2 Timothy 2:2. You haven't made a disciple. What Jason told me earlier, you haven't made a disciple until your disciples start making disciples. So what you're doing is working. We're multiplying, adding to the family, adding to the kingdom. So thank you guys. That's the movement model, and that's a little bit of my story too. So thank you guys.
Thank you for your transparency, and I can tell that it had an impact. You know, it's what we're all about, the power of a man pouring his life into another man, and you can now see the generational effect that it's having with your kids. That's just got to make you feel so good. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Really, really enjoyed hearing it. 450 pounds squat?
TJ is 148 pounds lifter. He squatted 804 pounds. I squatted 702.
Oh, God.
Later on, but I wasn't here.
I was impressed with 450. That's amazing. Oh, but yeah, thank you for sharing that. That was great. So our next presenter is our speaker for the weekend, Mr. Jim Donnelly, and I've had the pleasure of being around Jim in a focus group. I've been to his house. I've met his family. I know some of his Timothys. He was actually caught poaching in my fishing pond for a Timothy, and got him. And the guy was right under my nose, and I didn't see it, but Jim did, and I'm glad he did, because Craig's life's been changed forever. And I'm glad that you were able to form a relationship with him and get him, closer to God, and that's very important. But yeah, Jim's a very faithful guy. I love hearing him speak. He's like an adrenaline junkie, I think. You know, he's going to probably talk about that a little bit. But anyway, please help me welcome Mr. Jim Donnelly. He's going to talk about his life with us.
All right. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. Are you going to want to leave it right here?
That's fine by me. You did.
Okay.
That's good. Yeah, no problem. All right. Well, thanks, folks. Appreciate you hanging out on a night after the last night, that's for sure. That was quite an evening. And I just want to say thanks for allowing me to present this weekend. It's what I'm going to be talking about is I reached a milestone in my life. Was a year ago where I had 35 years in the world and 35 years in Christ. So I'm over the halfway point, which is it's awesome. First 35 years you're going to hear about tonight, which is was very interesting. Brad has passed out these discussion questions, which Rick had suggested I get them out tonight, because there's some pretty good stuff there that you might want to look at in your quiet time when discussing our groups tomorrow. Pretty interesting. Anyway, Just open up some prayer. Lord, thank you for giving me the opportunity to present tonight. I just pray that I get out of the way and you speak through me. Thank you for these men, their time spending, and pray for their families as they take the time away. But look after them as I know you will. And just pray for this time together and that you would have your will be done here. And we just enjoy the time just seeking you in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, here we go. So, the early years. I grew up in a small town, northern Illinois, a little farm town. I was the baby of the family. I had one brother, one sister. Mom and dad worked from home, and so my mom had her hair studio in the front of the house. My dad had, he was a foot doctor, so he had his foot doctor practice in front of the house. So we kind of had the town covered head to toe, you might say, you know. Anyway, so my parents, like I said, we lived in the back of the house and upstairs. So we were, you know, we were always together. And so that was an interesting dichotomy. We lived on a dead-end street, and our neighbor was a bar called Jake's Dead End Lounge. And northern Illinois towns were notorious for about the same number of churches as there were bars, you know. So anyway, so mom and dad would regularly go up to Jake's after their work, and so they'd tag me along as a little tyke, and they'd put me on a pinball machine, you know, and I'd be sitting there playing pinball while they're sitting at the bar. It was kind of like what was that movie or the show up Boston, but the bar where everybody got to know one another. Anyway, Cheers, that's it. So anyway, so my dad was developing a drinking problem, and I was starting to be a little bit concerned about this at a young age. I didn't really know when he'd get home, what condition he'd be in, so it was kind of discouraged. It was just tough. Anyway, we attended church in a grade school there in town, so my dad's drinking started really bothering, so but I really learned how to pray at that time as a young kid. I would pray to the statue Mary and pray that my dad would quit drinking, you know, and unfortunately he never did, but he'd be coming home at night, and you know, for me, I'd be in bed, and I just wondered what kind of condition he was going to be in when he came home, which wasn't very cool. But my mom, you know, she tried to shield us from as much as possible of the tirades, but for me, it was tough. You know, my relationship with my dad was not great. So I think I'm giving my dad a bad rap here, but you got to understand now. Here's my dad with working around women all day long. He even learned how to, got to where he could cut women's hair too. So he's cutting women's hair, taking care of their feet, and shoot, that would drive any man to drink as it is. So, but that's for sure. So I want to give him that credit. Plus, he grew up. His dad died when he was 4 years old, so he didn't have a father figure to emulate, and you know, so. Anyway, to his credit, he provided for the family, and here I am today because of that. But anyway, our little town was really cool to grow up in. I mean, I had a paper route, and I'd get on my little bicycle and deliver papers, and we'd walk to school, and so it was pretty good. You know, kids all over the neighborhood, and you go out in the day, and just come back at night for supper, and that was just the way it was. It was good stuff. So, but my father and his drinking, I started playing baseball and started, I started getting pretty good at that. But my dad would not, he just would not interface with me. He wouldn't come to my games. I started to really get annoyed at this and started to get, my anger started to well up against him and despise him. I said, I just couldn't understand it because the dad and the guy, and it's pretty normal. But anyway, it didn't happen. So I tried out for the high school baseball team, and I was getting to be a pretty good player, and I thought, oh man, no problem. And then, I got cut, and that was devastating for me. But actually, God played a big role in that, because when I didn't make the tennis team, then I didn't make the baseball team. I started playing for the tennis team, and now I've been playing tennis now for almost 62 years. I've been playing tennis. which, you know, what a great deal, you know. That was a good trade-off, so thank God for that. So my high school days are pretty normal, until a friend of mine that was a very good student, you know, one of the guys with the pen thing and your and all that, so he was a really smart guy. So he went over to Germany on an exchange program. So this is, I think, his junior year in high school. And so he went out straight as an arrow. He comes back from Germany, and it's hippie a la mode, man. I mean, he came back, long hair, beads, the whole nine yards. I'm going, what the heck? What happened to him, you know? I go, shoot. So anyway, I started hanging around with him, and so we started to experiment with drugs and things like that. I mean, I remember the disco ball, so he had this in his room, and tin foil over his, I mean, it was a little farm town, Illinois. So here comes Mr. Crazy Man. I go, holy cow, the guy's lost it. But anyway, enough of that. So anyway, so I graduated from school, and off to college I went. So now it's ultimate freedom. You know, you're on your own, and away you go. Well, I continued into the drug scene there, and it was, you know, got into it pretty heavily. And I was a member of a fraternity called Lambda Sigma Delta, LSD, of course. That was our symbol. So, anyway, spent 2 years at party school, and when God showed up in my life one morning, God woke me up, and I looked in the mirror, and that's 2 years of heavy drugs, and yeah, it was. I did not like what I saw. It was pretty ugly. And so what came to mind was, humble yourself under God's mighty hand, and He'll lift me up. Because man, I needed lifting up, because I was going down the wrong road big time. I'm just glad He came around. So God made me see that enough was enough of this lifestyle. So what was happening was college was having a career day. And so I said, okay, well, my goal was to get as far away from Illinois as possible and get away from this lifestyle. So they had a tennis camp out there, or a kids' camp that was looking for a tennis instructor. And so they hired me. I was in New Hampshire. And I said, okay, I'll take that. So the only requirement was that I cut my hair. And I said, okay, no problem. I can handle that. Just get away from Illinois as far as I could. So off I went. It was a great summer. I mean, I met this instructor out there that was teaching scuba diving. So we got to be good friends. And he had a 57 Chevy. So we would tour around in New Hampshire and New England on our days off. It was great. It was a great summer. So I asked him, I said, well, what are you going to do after this? You know, he says, well, I'm going to go become a deep sea diver. I said, deep sea diver? I said, what the heck's a deep sea diver? He says, well, you go to school and you go learn how to do that, and then you go down to Louisiana and you dive off these oil rigs. And I go, what's an oil rig? And I go, what the heck is all that? And I said, coming from Northern Illinois, I've never seen a wake bigger than a wake of a boat, you know, let alone. So, but I said, okay, that's a little bit more. I said, okay, my career decision, all right, that's what I'm going to do. So that instant, within about 5 seconds, all of a sudden I'm going to be a deep sea diver, and had a clue what it was. Anyway, so so God states, you know, I know, Lord, that a person's life is not his own. It's not his. It's not him who's going to direct the path, but God Himself. So here I am. I'm 51 years later in the oil business, and you know, and back to selling diving services. It's crazy, but that's God's amazing grace. That one decision at that point, and here I am 51 years later, still working at it. So there you go. But anyway. So after camp, my friend and Jim and I headed to my hometown. He needed to make some money to go to the dive school. So my parents were gracious enough to let him stay at the house, and we worked in the factory until he got enough money to head out. We were still smoking pot and whatever, but my dad was pretty tolerant of it back then. So we finally got enough money off in the 57 Chevy. We pack it up, and off to diving school we go in Oakland, California. And this is 1973, and we got an apartment in Berkeley. So here you are, a bunch of potheads in an apartment in Berkeley, going to deep sea diving school. Ay, ay, ay. You imagine that. So anyway, but we were faithful. I mean, we had to be at the school at 6 o'clock every morning, run 2 miles, and then jump in Oakland Harbor, learning how to tie knots and do whatever you're going to do in the oil field, you know. So we used to dive in the heavy gear, you know, with a big helmet and And I weighed about 160 pounds soaking wet. And I get this stuff weighed like 200 pounds when you got it all on. The helmet, the breastplate, the weights, the boots, and shoot, man. So I'm trying to get in and out of the ladder, as you can imagine. I go, oh, cool. So that's how I learned how to dive. So we had a good time. I mean, in Berkeley in 73, it was pretty cool. So one memory I have, one specific memory, which goes right along with my lifestyle, is I went to... They had a concert at Candlestick Park in San Francisco. Grateful Dead and Led Zeppelin. Cool. What a Sunday afternoon that was. I saw God that day. I believe that, man. That was a great concert. You can imagine. I mean, 50,000 people with Grateful Dead and Zeppelin. Whew, that was pretty good. Anyway, so the final test on the course, we're towards the end of it, was to get into a decompression chamber and they'll blow you down to 200 foot. Simulate 200 foot of water, you know. So with when you're diving, the nitrogen is a narcotic effect. So every 33 feet of water you go down is like having a martini, you know. So anyway, I think I was kind of hung over from the night before because I was having a pretty good time at 200 feet. You know, I was laughing it up and all that. Anyway, we all passed and finished the course. So now it's time to seek the fame and fortune, whatever that looked like. I still didn't know. I knew a little bit more about it, but not really. So we parted ways, and I started to Louisiana with this guy that in the school that had a VW bus. So we were tooling down from San Francisco down to Louisiana, hitting all the national parks, smoking dope, and that was a pretty good trip. So at that time, the oil industry was booming. So it wasn't too hard to find a job, but I had to be the greenest guy. I mean, not my whole body, but I knew nothing. I mean, my dad wasn't a mechanical kind of guy, so he never really got into teaching me anything about mechanics or anything for that matter. But so, like I said, I'm coming in here. I'm going, what the heck? Not only that, I go from Berkeley, California to Morgan City, Louisiana, as you can imagine, the cultural shock there in 1973. So anyway. So I finally got a job, and it looks like I'm going to go offshore. All right, great. So I'm going to find out what's going on. So we go offshore, and I'm on this rinkety-dink barge. I mean, we're out in deep water, and this thing can... I mean, this is a pretty sad barge. I ain't kidding you. Talk about a mess. So we get on this thing, and I'm out there, and I'm just taking all this stuff in. I don't know anything that's going on. And then they start talking about a hurricane's coming. I go, a hurricane? I go, oh my gosh. Shoot, I don't know nothing about seas or anything like that. And so they said, well, the barge can be towed at 3 miles an hour on a good day. And, you've got 15-foot seas. And just, you know, I go outside and I look. I go, oh my God. Oh, I'm dead. I swear to God. I went and put my wetsuit on. And I just sat in the back of the barge thinking, for sure I'm dead. And nobody would come and say, hey, man, it's going to be okay. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, my gosh, it's all over for sure. I mean, come on, you look out there, it's a freaking hurricane. And I did live through it. And when I did get to the beach, I just kissed the ground, man. I said, oh, my gosh, I survived. I couldn't believe it. Thank God. So that was my first experience offshore. So... anyway, apparently, the Lord said, trust in the Lord and lean not on my own understanding. Well, obviously, I wasn't understanding anything, but I got to the beach and I said, I got all this invested in this. I'll go see what else I can do. So I didn't stay with that company because obviously I was so embarrassed that here I am in this wetsuit and everybody's in there playing card and having a good, but here I am just going, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. For sure I'm going to die. Anyway. So I decided to leave that company, and God's gracious enough to lead me to a company that I stayed with for the rest of my diving career. It was Ocean Systems Incorporated down in Morgan City, a smaller company, which was hired by the oil companies to do many of their different types of projects. So it was a great place to learn the diving profession. So the day I got hired, there were two brothers that were hiring that same day. So we all got a place together, and the one guy that hung with me, we're still good friends to this day, you know. I got to then start to learn the equipment necessary for diving, because I mean, you've got a guy's life on the line every day you're diving, so you've got to have a really intimate knowledge of the equipment. So I was fortunate to have a black gentleman that was the mechanical guy taking care of all the mechanics. And he was an old black guy, but he was really cool. His name was Bill Francis, and he'd smoke heavy Salem cigarettes, and at the end he'd be chewing on the butt, you know. But he was great. He took me under his wing, learn how to, you know, start compressors, work on compressors, and get the kind of equipment so that I at least could understand a little bit what was going on. So then, I dove in the Gulf of Mexico for 5 years, and I was fortunate enough to start with an apprenticeship under this guy that named Glenn Taylor, which is this guy was an incredible diver. I mean, it was amazing what he could do. So I started out being his tender and just taking care of his needs and all that. And he taught me so much, and you know, just to see the work that he could do. Because when we're diving out there in the Gulf, you're typically working on pipelines, so you have no visibility. So you're doing everything by feel, you know. You're putting in pipelines and all this heavy equipment. Again, the barge is going up and down, the pipes are going up and down. You're trying to tie them together, and oh my God! Anyway, this guy was amazing. So I remember one of my first dives, I tentative enough, and then in any apprenticeship, you learn the craft, and then you start getting in the water diving. So I remember one of my first dives was hand jetting, which burying a pipeline between this lake and Louisiana. It was about 4 feet of water, maybe 5 feet of water. So if you stood up, you'd be out of the water, you know. But, you know, we would jet this thing down, and snakes and cypress stumps and alligators and all the stuff. You can't see nothing. And anyway, so that was one of the first jobs I got to do. Another one was a tugboat. You know, we would cut rope out of the wheels and stuff like that. And this one was in the middle of winter. So I go out on the job, and it's, you know, you go out on deck, and there's ice on the deck. The water's freezing, and you got to jump in the water, try to cut this rope out of this wheel, and you can't see anything, and your hands are so damn cold, you cut your finger off, and it's, you know. So I made all of $100 on that dive, and I was sick for 2 weeks after that, trying, you know, with an ear infection. Anyway, it's a part of becoming a diver, you know. I said, all right. So I began to establish myself as a trusted team member and started getting on more challenging projects. As a diver, you're always looking for a challenging project to build up your reputation, but you also wanted to get the deepest dive you can, because you get paid a day rate and you get depth pay. So for each foot you go down, you get paid another X amount of dollars per foot. So you're always looking for the deeper job so you can get the depth pay and all that. So I remember we were doing a hot tap out there, and a hot tap is where you're going to go in and drill into a live pipeline, and you're going to tie another line into it without, you understand hot tap. Anyway, the superintendent, this guy's, you know, well-known diver, you know, everybody looks up to him. Oh. So he's back on back deck, and we're going to lower this hot tap tool to tie into the pipe. So he goes, I'm putting in this special knot so that when the diver gets down there, all you got to do is flip it and it'll let go and you can get to work. So he ties this knot, we're all looking at him. They lift it up and they put it over the boat, and all of a sudden, boop, the tool goes down in 200 foot of water. I'm going, everybody's going, holy, he's going, where'd it go? So anyway, fortunately, this thing landed just about right, spot on the pipeline, you know. I mean, but everybody just go, oh, you know, this guy, oh, this knot is special. Oh, yeah, it's special, all right. Right down to the bottom. That was classic. So that was pretty interesting. So anyway, now we're doing this hot tap. So I'm down there hand jetting 200 feet of water, okay, on air. So I'm going along, I can't see nothing, I'm just jetting away, and I'm singing to myself because I'm getting knocked out, you know. So they said, he's getting giddy. So this is totally against any decompression rule, whatever. So what they do is they shoot me some helium oxygen mixture to clear my head, you know, so get the nitrosis out of there so they continue diving. And then they ran me on an air table, which is, that's how crazy, and they called it a cocktail. Give him a cocktail, clear his head up. Oh my gosh. And I was pretty narked out too, I have to admit. But anyway, that was the crazy stuff you did way back when, before HR departments and safety of things and all this other stuff that we have these days, you know, which is good, because what was happening is the drilling companies were drilling in 100 foot of water was deep back then, you know. But then they started drilling 200 feet of water and 300 feet of water and 400 feet. And we were going out there, going deeper and deeper. The decompression tables were terrible because all we were using was Navy dive tables. And they never know the kind of depths we were in. Bottom times we were down there diving at. So it was, we were guinea pig is what we were. And each company was building their own sets of tables and building it on certain dives. Guy gets bent, bent being, not, getting the decompression sickness, what they call it, and just bubbles forming. So they indicate that and try to, anyway, it was wide open crazy. So, all right, so then we did this one job. This one was pretty cool. We called it live boating. So what it was is you go out and they lay a pipe, these barges lay these pipelines on bottom, and we would go behind them in a boat and inspect the line on bottom, and we'd call it walking pipe. So we'd be up on the surface, 150, 200 feet of water, whatever it is, and you'd jump off the boat, go down and jump down into the water and start walking this pipe, going joint, joint, joint. A joint is where they join the pipelines together, the two pieces together. You go joint, joint, joint. And the boat's up here with the screws running, and the tender's out there, and they're following your bubbles, and they're directing the boat to follow your bubbles, you know? And the screws are going. So, I mean, you got currents and everything you're dealing with. And so but I love those jobs. Those are great. Because what you do is you get, first of all, you got your equipment on, then you got your helmet, and you got your weight belt, and you got a bailout bottle, small bit of air that if you lose the air supply, you can hook that in and have a couple breaths. So you got all this on and you go jump in, okay, do your dive, and then you got 5 minutes to come up, and you got 5 minutes to get from 40 foot of water into the decompression chamber. And that's so you got to get from 40 feet of water where you're doing your last water stop up the ladder, get all your gear off, and get in the decompression chamber in 5 minutes, because what's happening is the bubbles are starting to form, so you got to get back into, you can recompress them to get them back in solution, you know. So in five minutes time, you're running across the deck trying to get up the ladder, and you'd be in maybe 4 or 5 foot seas, and your ladder's going up and down, and you're trying to get on that, and away you go. So, and then you had to have your tender with your cigarette waiting for you, so you get a few puffs in before you jump in the decompression chamber for another couple hours. Anyway, so I love this type of project, though. We'd get done diving, and we couldn't dive at night, obviously, because you couldn't see the bubbles. So we'd go tie up to a platform, and then we would go in and we'd snorkel, scuba dive. We'd go spear fishing, spiny diving. It was great. I mean, so the first time I'm on one of these, I go jump in the water, go snorkeling over the platform and see what was going on. I jump in and the bubbles clear, you know, and jump in and the bubbles. And the first thing is a barracuda just right in my face going, "Arr!" I go, "Oh my God," trying to get to the back to the ladder, almost drowned right then. I mean, "Gah!" I go, "Holy God." Anyway, it was hard work and all, but man, we had a good time. Anyway. So in the early, like I said, in the early days, in the 70s, the water depths were getting deeper and deeper, and the Navy tables were, they just weren't working. They weren't doing well. So I'm doing this one dive, and I'm decompressing on the platform and hanging onto the platform on my way up. And so I lift my arm up like this, and all of a sudden, it's like somebody opened a champagne bottle. I could just feel the bubbles going. I go, "Oh, man." I say, "Well, add another 10 or 20 minutes to my decompression time to keep the, you know, get these back in solution, because shoot, that's right then, that's a bend just waiting to happen." And with the bends, anywhere your bloodstream is going, it'll lodge, and so, you know, in the brain it'll kill you, whatever. But typically it's in the joints is where the blood flow will be restricted, and that's where they hurt like heck, you know. So anyway. And also, we didn't have hot water. So, you're diving 250 feet on on helium oxygen, no hot water. So you're diving hour bottom times. You're in the water for hours. And when you're breathing helium oxygen, when you exhale, your body heat goes out with it because it's a light gas. And man, talk about cold. You just can't, man, I've never been colder. I never want to be that cold again. I was so cold, you couldn't talk. Teeth are chattering. And the way we typically tried to combat that is you just save, you drink a bunch of fluid and try to pee in your wetsuit to get warm. That was one way to get warm. I mean, believe me, it was. Now they've got hot water, they got all this fancy dance stuff, and back then you just did it, you know? So anyway, my career progressed and started diving deeper in what we call a thing called bell bounce, which is really insane diving. So what it is you've got a decompression chamber on the surface, and you got a bell that comes in and mates onto this decompression chamber. So what the bell is basically your elevator down to where you work, you know? So you get in this bell and lock it closed, and then they lower you down to where the work's going to be done, and you identify where the work's going to be done and get the bell situated just right, and then you blow it, what they call blow down. You open up this valve and you just blow down as fast as you can so you can get as much bottom time to work as you can. But what happens is you blow down so fast that you get high pressure nervous system attack, because in your body hasn't been able to keep up with the depth change, and you're just shaking until that clears up, and then you can get your hat on and go to work, you know. So they don't do that anymore either, but anyway. So a lot of, you know, that's typically 300 foot of water or more is what you're bell bouncing in. I did a lot of that. Might be a reason why I might be crazy at times, because it was so insane. You'd get down there, you'd go out, do your work, 30, 40, whatever the minutes is, and you had to get back to the bell as fast as you could, so they could pick the bell up to cut your bottom time so you wouldn't have to decompress any longer than you're already going to have to anyway. And then they switch gases on the other. It was so nuts. You got two guys in the bell, and you look out there, and you know, this big fish would come by, and like the big, huge jewfish would come and fill the port with its eyeballs looking in. You go, okay, your dive. Go out and go get it, man. And out you go. Yeah, that was crazy. And I did a lot of that. I mean, that was most of my career was bell balancing. Man, oh man. Anyway. So God allowed me to become a fairly experienced diver in the Gulf. So then I decided that I would go overseas diving. So I took a contract down in Colombia, offshore Colombia, diving off the Glomar rigs down there. So at that time, this is 77, 78, and it was the drug traffic there was just, you know, wide open. I mean, you know, the DEA and everybody haven't gotten in there yet, so it was just crazy. And we were outfitting the rig out in Santa Marta, which was the export capital of the world for Colombian drugs. I mean, it was just where they all went out of there. So we had a bell bounce system on this rig, and it was a rollover, what they call a rollover system. So the rig didn't have enough room to typically it's a your bell goes mates on vertically. Well, this one you had to come in and mate sideways, so because the rig didn't have enough room to have it vertical. So with a rollover bell, when you're in there and you come in to mate up after your dive, this thing rolls over. So anything that didn't tie down comes flying on you. And, you know, so then you go in anyway. So we did that. I did that for 2.5 years in Colombia, bell bouncing, small crew, 300 foot of water was typical. But we lived in this town called Cartagena. Man, that was nice. I was 25 years old, 6'2", blonde hair, blue eyes, and the Colombian women were really attractive. So my day consisted of, let's see, first I get up, I go body surfing, then I go to my favorite restaurant on the beach, and then the afternoon I go play tennis with the company man, and then at night I go down to the bar and mix drinks and whatever, and then we occasionally go too. But so it was a pretty good life. I didn't realize how good I had it. So I completed that contract, but I wasn't ready to leave Colombia. Colombia was great. I really loved Colombia. The people were really cool, and it was really, really a nice time. So I met this guy on the beach, and he was a treasure diver. He'd go out and he'd go to the archives, and he'd go out and find out where these wrecks are, and he'd go dive them. And he found a lot of good stuff. So anyway, he was telling me we'd go out a couple times with his metal detector, and we found this place called the Money Tree. And we, with our metal detector, we'd find a doubloon here, a doubloon there. You know, it was pretty cool. But then he said, hey, look, there's a there's this place up in the mountains where the conquistadors had been up there mining gold, and that's where they were getting all their gold to send over to Spain. And they left this place up there where they couldn't get down to bedrock to get all the big gold and everything that's going to be there, you know. I said, really? So I went up. So I said, okay, well, let's take a look at this place. So we go, had to fly to one city, get on a boat to take us to, a banana boat to take us to one tributary, and then get a dugout canoe to go up to where this place was, you know. So I went, and sure enough, there it was. I said, okay, well, all right, let's do it. Crazy as I was, okay, let's do it. So I go back and I recruit a couple of my diving buddies. I said, okay, we're going to go mining gold in the Andes Mountains. All right, that sounds great. Anyway, we get a Volkswagen engine, six-inch PVC pipe, hydraulic elevators, hookah rig for diving, and we load all this on a banana boat in Cartagena, Colombia, to go up to this river and drop it off in this little village there. So there's 15 huts in this little village, and this guy that's the kind of the mover shaker of the village has two separate families in these 15 huts. And so he comes up and gets us we buy a 25-foot dugout canoe from the local authorities with a 25-horsepower motor on it. We've got four drums of 55-gallon drums of diesel, a Volkswagen, and all this stuff, and we start portering it up river, an 8-hour journey up river to get to where this place was. So now, honest to God, what insanity. Anyway, so we get up there, and there was this hut where we were going to stay with this family, and we had hammocks, and we just strung it in their hut thing, and that's so we just hung there for about a month and a half trying to get this pit dried out so we could get to the big mother load. Well, we could never overcome the water table, so there you go, no matter what we did. Anyway, so we said, okay, we're going to go upstream. So we're going to go further upstream, and there were still the native people, the black people were there. But so now we're going to move upstream, another 4 hours upstream to this place where it was a side of a river with a bank, you know, and we rigged up the our sluice box into the bedrock so you could just wash this down with this Volkswagen engine, just wash the dirt down, let it go through the sluice box, and we're going to be millionaires. Yeah, okay. Good idea. Right. So we get everything set up, and one day we did have one guide, a local guide with us, that one of the guys from the hut, and he, all of a sudden here comes down the river comes this balsa log with a chicken hawk, spread eagle on this thing, and we're going, what the heck is this? Because there's no more black people, it was only natives, blowgun folks, you know. And here comes this chicken hawk thing, and the guy goes, oh man, bad news. They're not very appreciative of you being here. I said, oh, okay, well, that's great. Well, anyway, we said, well, we come this far, we ain't leaving now, you know. So we said, man, we're ready to hit the mother load. So that night, it starts raining. And it wasn't just raining. I mean, it was like last night here, only constant. And so we get hit with a flash flood, and we end up the trees to get out of the water. And fortunately, we had a long enough rope on our canoe that it didn't go too, but all of our equipment, down the river it went. And we go, oh my, this is it, man. So we start down the river picking stuff out of trees, and oh my gosh, it was unbelievable. I was wondering how these huge rocks got out in the middle of this river. Well, I know now, that's for sure. So what we could find, we loaded in a banana boat to go back to Cartagena, and a guy, one of our group, volunteered to ride the boat back, so he rides it back, and he gets malaria on the way back. He gets up to New Orleans and he's sick, and they go, you got, we haven't seen malaria here in how long. And he caught malaria on this banana boat heading back to Cartagena. Anyway, so I wasn't done with Colombia yet. There's another crazy one. So I had met this girl, and she was a senator's daughter or something. Anyway, she was, I don't know. But anyway, I told her, I said, look, I want to buy some emeralds, you know, while I'm in Colombia here. And I hear they got the best emeralds in the world. She says, okay, yeah, we could probably arrange that. So I flew up to Bogota, and off into the jungle we go to buy these emeralds. I have $5,000 and $100 bills in my shoes, and I'm trucking through the jungle. I said, why I had it in my shoes, I have no idea. I mean, if they knew they had it, they'd just kill me and be done with it, you know? So anyway, We did get to the place to buy. I did buy the emeralds, and we made it out of there. So then I'm coming back home finally, and so I said, "What am I going to do with these emeralds? I got to go through customs." So I put the emeralds in between my toes and walked through customs with the emeralds between my toes. I still have them to this day. That's how crazy I was. Anyway, so I returned to the Gulf of Mexico, continued my diving career. Somewhat sane, but I did 2 years in Venezuela as well. After that, I finished Colombia, then I went over to Venezuela and did 2 years over there. I got back to the Gulf. There was this project, a jackup rig, one of these big jackup rigs with the pontoons. So they were switching locations in the South China Sea, and a storm was coming, so they got a permission to jack down. Well, they jacked two of their three pontoon legs on a 20-inch pipeline and took out 160 foot of 20-inch pipe. So, all right, so they fly us all over from Houston to do a what they call the hyperbaric weld, which is you put down a habitat around the pipe and you blow out all the water and you do a regular surface weld in the habitat. So that's what we were doing. 100 foot of water, 140 foot of water, just crystal clear. I mean, you could look from the bar down, see the pipe. It was awesome water. Only problem was, it was full of sea snakes. I mean, sea snakes big time. I mean, at night when we were diving, you have lights on the water. They were just stirring. I mean, and you'd have to throw something in the water to get a space to go dive down to work on the habitat with all these snakes everywhere. You'd be down there working away, and when we'd go, well, whatever. And these things are the deadliest snake in the world. I mean, you can't... Anyway, they have really small mouths, so it's really hard for them to bite you. But anyway, that's reassuring. So anyway, we're on this job. It was crazy. We had the welder divers, and we were the other divers. So this one guy, I'm running the air, radio. I'm running the dive, you know, and... So I said, okay, time to come up. He's doing his decompression stops, and he keeps going, I go, what the heck, man? So I jump the standby dart. What's wrong? You bent? He goes, no, I'm okay. So I said, okay, time to get him up, and he's taking forever to come up the ladder. I go, come on, man. So the first thing I see come up on deck, boom, is a 15-pound lobster. So this guy has had this lobster in his wetsuit during decompression, and it was just beating him in the chest. That's what he was screaming about. I go, well, don't worry, get the lobster, and don't worry about it. Anyway, that's a true story. I couldn't. Anyway, can you imagine the tail on that thing just beating you? That's how nuts we were. Anyway, my next assignment was in the North Sea. So now, in the Gulf of Mexico, we had all this small equipment, you know, wasn't much. I mean, just enough to make a dive and whatever. So then I fly over to the North Sea. I'm going to run a saturation ship on the DP 101, which is the largest derrick bird in the world at that time. So I go into the dive shack where all the control room is, and I go in there. I go, oh, holy! I mean, it looked like NASA big time. There's a 24-man saturation diving system with all the gauges and everything you could ever. I go, holy moly, man! Yeah, I'm not in Kansas anymore. That's for sure. I go, wow. But what was really cool, though, as we were flying out on the chopper, the weather came up and they had to shut us down, and we shut down in the Shetland Islands, which is out in the North Sea, in the middle of the North Sea, and nobody ever goes there. And we got to shut down there, so we got to spend 6 hours on the Shetland Islands and cruise around and see. That was pretty cool. A lot of sheep, but that was pretty good. So anyway, we were out there, okay. So we're out there on this job, and a storm blows up. But it just wasn't any storm. This was a hurricane that came from the Gulf and was blowing over to the North Sea. So we had 100-mile-an-hour winds out there on this thing. We stayed on location, and we were setting a big jacket in 400 feet of water. So for safety of the barge and the platform we're setting, they set it on bottom, you know. And there was about 100 foot of freeboard from the surface of the water to the top of this. And the seas were breaking over the top of that. 100-foot seas. And we're out there. And I mean, whoa, was that something? Man, I've never... That was an eye-opener, to say the least. So, and they were big... I mean, anyway, it was something. So there, that's diving. And that's only a small brush of really what went on, all the dives that I made and all those years of not being able to see anything and going down and body searches and just a lot of stuff. Anyway, so after 12 years of active diving around the world, I decided to get out of the water. The stress on the body and the uncertainty of when you might be called out on the next job had finally taken its toll. I was offered a position as estimator for Ocean Systems, which I accepted. Now, this put me in the office bidding diving jobs and the duration of the, how long would it take, you know, about the bidding of jobs and all that. So, anyway, at times, coming, I think for anything, when you're coming out of a field operation and coming into the office, that's, it can be a tough transition. I managed it all right, though. But I was still, I was still drinking and smoking dope and all that. So all that meant was now I got more time to drink and smoke and become crazy. Anyway, so I was still in Morgan City, and I got an offer to move to Lafayette, Louisiana, with another company, which I took that position and was an assistant operations manager. And back then the diving business was going nuts. I mean, we were diving crews in and out, and so we didn't have cell phones then, so you had this beeper, and all days and night, beep, 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 and I'd go to the office, load out a job, divers coming in, gotta give them, oh my gosh. We did that for 2 years, and we had a saying, we said, ASAP! So, ASAP! Because everything's ASAP. We got $1 million spread out there, ASAP! You gotta get everything, oh my gosh. Anyway, it's driving me nuts. So, with all this ASAP stuff going on and 2 years of insanity, me and the owner of the company didn't get along all that well. Every time I suggest something, he thought I was out of my mind. I was going to try and do the best I could for the company. But anyway, he didn't like me very much, so that's life. One day I'm driving back at night after a night of drinking or whatever. I drive my car right into the ditch, man. I mean, I'm going to die. So all I can say on that, the Bible states that there are not God's angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who would inherit eternal salvation. Well, I hadn't inherited it yet, but I was on my way, and boy, did I need some angels. So anyway, what happened was I got the company opened a job in New Orleans, office in New Orleans, so they asked me to go over there and help start it up, which I accepted. It got me away from this guy. And during this time as ops manager as well, I was, I was sending out gear, and I was renting gear, and getting all the pieces together, and you got $1 million a day spread out there, and everybody's saying, "Get it out here! Holy cow, the world's coming to an end!" And I was going nuts. But these vendors would come, these two guys would come in, and they'd just be calm as to be, and I'm going, "Hey, man, don't you understand it's ASAP time?" And they go, "Oh yeah, okay, well, I'll get you your stuff. Don't worry." I said, "Okay," and they'd always come through, And I go, "What the heck is wrong with these guys? Don't they know it's ASAP?" Anyway, so they had something that I didn't have, that's for sure. And I go, "What the heck do they, what is it? What's wrong with these guys? Who are these guys?" Anyway, so we'd go to lunch occasionally and whatever, and they'd start talking to me about God and, and the Bible. And I'm going, "Well, I don't know about it. I've grown up as a kid, all right, well, sort of, whatever." So anyway, one of the guys that was calling on me in Lafayette was also in New Orleans. So when I got transferred to New Orleans, we started hooking up. And, he really was really great. He took me under his wing and, introduced me to his family. He was a great guy. Paul was his name. So he said he invited me to a seminar, a CBMC seminar in New Orleans. I said, "Is that all right? I guess I can go see what that's all about." So off I went to the seminar the first night. And, okay, the guy, whatever. I said, "Okay, well, maybe that's not for me, maybe not. But, okay, I'll come back the second night just to be, this guy's invited me. I'll go ahead and do that." So, anyway, I'm in there, and they brought up the illustration of the, in book two, I think it is, where you've got the canyon, and you have God on one side, man on the other, and no way of bridging that gap, And then the next slide is where Christ comes in with the cross and bridges that gap, and man, that hit me like lightning. I said, "Man, that's it. That is what I've been looking for all these years, all this insanity, and I guess maybe there is hope for me." So we went, that night we just went, we went out, went to a bar and was just having a drink, and he asked me, he said, you know, would you like to accept the Lord as your Lord and Savior? I go, I think I would. I think what he said tonight is just, you know, that's an answer I've been looking for all my life, you know. So he said the, you know, I stated that.
So a guy from Stephen Peter City.
Yeah.
Took you after a bar.
After the seminar.
After the seminar.
That was. That's it. Said the Lord's Prayer right there, the sinner's prayer. I said, Lord, I'm a sinner through and through. There ain't no doubt about that. You know, I believe that you died on the cross for my sins. I believe that you died on the cross. I believe that God raised you from the dead, and I ask you to come into my life and become my Lord and Savior, because Lord knows I need one. So,
at the bar.
And then I turn around and get something to eat, and there's a bowl of goldfish there. So that's pretty ironic, you know, the little goldfish with the Christian symbol. So that's how I came to know Christ after 35 years of massive insanity. So tomorrow I'll go into the 35 years of my walk with Christ, which is a little more, you know, it's a little tamer, but not a whole lot. Because I'm...
During the course of all the and then you start talking about the welding and stuff. When did you learn to weld?
I didn't weld. I would just set the habitat, and I would place what they call the monkey shit all around the pipe so the gas wouldn't leak out, because they would fill it up with an inert gas, and then the diver welder would go down, enter the habitat, and then weld in the dry, do TIG weld in the dry. And that's the way they used to do it way back when.
So the welders were divers as well?
Yeah, yeah, diver welders, huh?
You just never
learned how to... Yeah, well, I wasn't a welder. I mean, it's easier to take a welder and make him a diver than just take a diver and make him a welder, in my opinion, that is. But the diver welders come out on deck, it's diver welder, and that's all they would do. And we're out there busting our butt trying to set everything up and diving with the snakes and all that, you know. So anyway. It was a heck of a career, I'll tell you what. People ask me, they say, what were you thinking? I said, well, obviously I wasn't thinking. Well, I wouldn't be doing this stuff, you know, that's for sure. And I mean, that's just a brush of what we went through. I mean, they just erected a memorial to the deep sea divers and what they contributed to the oil field and how they let the advancement get to where it is today, you know. And it was really cool. And so they got this bronze statue down in Morgan City, and that was nice because we did so many crazy things. Just wouldn't imagine. You can't imagine in the dark. I mean, you're kind of doing all this by feel, and you got a boat up there or a barge, and it's going up and down, and the pipe's going up and down. You're trying to put two flanges together, and they're going like this. And you know, I got all my fingers though. But anyway. And alive, well.
What kind of pressure do you experience?
Well, I've been to 430. That's the deepest I've dove. And you feel the pressure, not so much your body equalizes with it, you know. But what you feel is as your hand movements and hammering things or whatever you're working down there, that's where you feel the resistance there more than anything, you know. And so, but. I mean, every 33 feet, you're adding 14.7 pounds per square inch of pressure, you know. So you're down 300 feet, you got 140 pounds of pressure from the water weight pushing on you, you know. Yeah, it was amazing. It was you had to be there to appreciate it, that's for sure. Anyway, thanks for listening. Yes, Bobby. What's that now?
When did you get married? First
35? No, not that was not diving. Marriage did not get along.
Okay.
I was wise enough to understand that.
So tomorrow
I'll go into all that, all the after, whatever. But I mean, I got so many good friends that experience this stuff, and we get divers reunions together, and I mean, it's a unique group of individuals, let's put it like that. That's for sure. But thanks for listening.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
I've heard most of that before. I never get tired of the head to toe story about your parents. I think that's always funny. But you know, I knew about the diving. You're an avid tennis player. How you just decided on a whim to go be a diver. But I had never heard that you were an emerald smuggler. International emerald smuggler. I can add that to the list. That was awesome. Thank you, Jim. And we're looking forward to hearing more tomorrow. Okay, so that concludes our presentations for the evening. Now we can move into dessert and fellowship, one of my favorite topics. So, John, do we need, as you can see on your the agenda, we start breakfast at 7 to 8:15, and then we'll get our program started at 8:15. But coffee will be ready at 6.
A little presentation after breakfast, and then we'll start.
What's that?
A little presentation of Living Proof.
Yes, yeah, the testimony Living. Yeah, okay, very good. So, without any further ado, we're adjourned to dessert. Anybody have any questions about the living quarters or anything? We can. Okay.